That, of course, is the Beach Boys, one of the many bands featured in Joel Selvin's new book, Smart Ass, and Joel Selvin is with us. Hi there.
Good to be here, Scott.
You can't talk about California music without the Beach Boys, the most iconic band, perhaps. Really did more than any other music group, I think, to create the image of California in the 1960s.
I agree. Brian Wilson saw something in his life in Hawthorne, California, which is kind of a lower middle class suburb of Los Angeles, not too far from the airport. But it was a 20-minute bus ride to Manhattan Beach, where some of the early surfers were working out. And his younger brother, Dennis, used to take that bus ride and come back and tell Brian about this. Now, also, about 10 blocks away from Brian's home was a big toy company called Mattel Toys. And they were manufacturing the Barbie doll. The Barbie doll was a product of the American Dream, California style. So were the Beach Boys records. They were the vision of that culture. And Brian, in a kind of innocent, almost idiot savant kind of level of genius, was able to encapsulate this stuff so perfectly in his pop records. He reminds me very much of Norman Rockwell's illustrations, capturing something that seems cliched but was not really until it fell together in such perfect sort of order in that artwork.
A troubled family, too.
Very. Murray Wilson, the father, was a driving force in the kid's career and a very abusive father. Had an alcoholic mother, Audrey. The brothers, Dennis and Carl and Brian, were always shielding each other from the family situation. The cousin, Mike Love, was the singer, and he had another troubled family. It was a very difficult situation.
So different, the reality, so different from the image of the band and their music.
Like show business in Hollywood, very much. It was a Southern California Hollywood event, the Beach Boys. They had this golden, sunny land of opportunity picture of California painted in their songs, but underneath there was a lot of darkness and despair.
So you describe the pieces, these features in this book, as sort of the backstory of the hit parade. Why do you call it that?
Well, the front end of all this is the music, and the reason we're there is because we like listening to music and enjoy the artwork of the musicians. What I'm dealing with is the behind the curtain in the Wizard of Oz studio. What's it like for the musicians in the lab assembling the parts and pieces and putting it together? I think that there's a lot of their lives in the music, and I think we detect that when we listen to it and identify with it and you think, yeah, that's a great song. There's something about it that the alchemy is that we think that they are singing about themselves.
Well, that might be a good cue to hear some Merle Haggard music. This is a track called California Blues.
Well, I'm going to California where they sleep out every night. I'm going to California where they sleep out every night. I'm leaving you, mama, 'cause you know you don't treat me right.
Merle Haggard, he grew up in Oildale down in Kern County, but you interviewed him up in Redding where he, I don't know if he still lives there.
Yeah, he lives there, yeah.
Yeah, you call him an outsider. What is it about him that attracted you?
He's an amazing character. He stands completely outside the norm of society. He was raised in a Quonset hut with a dirt floor. His family was the Grapes of Wrath, actual people that were from Oklahoma and struggling to make a living. And Merle was that guy that turned 21 in prison doing life without parole. His music is filled with that. And he's never been anything but one-faced, honest guy who looks at life with this kind of certainty.
Yeah. Maybe at the other end of the musical mood, you might say, the Grateful Dead band from iconic band also with a huge following in the 60s and 70s. You say you're a non-deadhead.
No, I don't qualify as a deadhead. But I always went to the shows like at least once a year, as I always used to say, just to keep my card in. They're terribly amusing people. They're very bright and witty. And the things that the band got into over the years was just always a constant source of great newspaper articles. And some of the finest moments of my musical listening career come from Grateful Dead concerts. I wouldn't single any one concert out from beginning to end, but geez, Scott, you know, New Year's Eve, 1968-69 at Winterland, 5,400 people in the audience, 6 people on stage, everybody under the influence of LSD.
Well, why don't we listen to some Dead music? This is something called Estimated Profit. Joel Selvin, what goes through your mind when you hear that music?
You know, I was in the recording studio with producer Keith Olsen when he played that track for the band the first time. Now, they'd played it, obviously, but he'd done a lot of overdubs. There's a Tom Scott sax solo, and he'd done a mix, and he was going to play the more of this overdubs that he'd done. But this was the first song, and it was a little tense moment. I remember Bobby Weir going, "Hey, Jerry, listen to this." And then the sax solo came in and they listened to the sax solo. And Jerry's sitting next to Keith. He goes, "I don't know. It sounds a little busy."
It's my impression from the book, and maybe it's just the features that you chose for this book, that in some ways you found Jerry Garcia to be the least interesting of the Grateful Dead.
Oh, that's not so at
no?
all.
Okay.
No. The Jerry Garcia is one of the most brilliant, interesting people I ever knew. And Jerry was very deferential. He wanted to know what you knew. He wanted to know what you were listening to. He wanted to know what you were reading. He was on constantly trying to pick up clues and find little messages from somewhere. So he wasn't your typical sort of rock star who, well, enough about me. What do you think of me? Jerry was a very and a genius guitar player. The idea that there's any point to being a Grateful Dead without Jerry Garcia, I find really ridiculous.
And he totally overshadowed, really, the other band members. At least that comes out in some of the other articles you wrote after he died.
I think that the secret of the Grateful Dead was that each one of the members privately thought they were the reason that the band was special. But they all deferred to Jerry, who had a unique personality. He was not a leader in the sense of making decisions. He tended to be passive aggressive and let other people make decisions, but have him say it was okay to do it.
You can't tell the story of music in California in this era that you've covered without drugs, of course, and the Dead are a great example of that. What influence do you think drugs had on all this music, this sweep of time in the 60s, 70s, and 80s?
You know, there's a lot of sort of revisionist thinking that tries to eliminate the history of drug use out of the rock music explosion of the 60s. It's really impossible. They're so closely tied together. And it's a culture in this country, America, has problems facing the whole nature of drugs and their role in our lives. So I'm not averse to admitting, to facing up to the idea that, well, you know, LSD broke down a lot of creative barriers for people. It opened up a lot of doors in people's ability to make different kinds of music, to respond to this music differently. And there's other drugs that were involved, too, and not necessarily to the benefit.
I was a little surprised to read that the musician that you admire most, or you said you admire no musician more than Steve Miller.
Yes, that's true.
What is it about him?
So much.
And we should just say, for folks who don't know, how would you describe Steve Miller's music?
Well, Steve Miller,
best known for The Joker, probably.
I guess. And those 70s pop rock hits, Take the Money and Run.
Jet Airliner.
But to me, you know, I think of Steve as somebody who's so deeply embedded in the music. Les Paul taught him his first guitar chords when he was 5 years old. When he was nine, T-Bone Walker was showing him how to play lead guitar in Dallas. His father was a doctor who had an amateur tape record hobby, and he hung out with musicians. So Steve has been around musicians all his life and some of the greatest in our history. So he's, by the age of 15, backing up Jimmy Reed in Dallas nightclubs. He didn't even make a record for another 10 years in his life that we've heard. Think about his guitar playing. I've underrated as a blues guitarist. A guy like Eric Clapton, so famous for that skill. I think, you know, if he was to stand on a stage and play with Steve, you know, he'd be backing off as soon as he could.
You also profile some of the people who are part of the business. Bill Graham, the rock impresario who died in a helicopter accident, I think in 91, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Phil Spector, who is such a character. And most people...
Character's a funny word for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's most people may remember the image of him at the trial with his crazy hair. And he also had a very troubled background, starting with his parents, who you write were first cousins.
First cousins, yeah. Phil Spector, destiny as a convicted murderer. Wow. It's just an amazing end to that story. Of course, he was the teenage millionaire, the guy who had sold millions of records by the time he was 21, and he invented all kinds of sounds and broke through all kinds of creative barriers to make these magnificent records, and had such control of his own business that he was a force of extraordinary proportions. And he saw himself as a legend. So he created himself in many ways as a legend. And then to back into this reclusive lifestyle, living in mansions, keeping vampire hours for, you know, the next 30 years of his life, virtually holding his wife prisoner. It's like some dark Dickensian novel. And then to have it play out in these final scenes of this guy, his wigs are off, he's sitting in some cell, he's wearing a yarmulke, he's gone kosher, he's taken special diets, and you know, he's going to live his life out in prison.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Let me ask you about another singer-songwriter who you write about in the book, Tom Waits. And his voice, so distinctive, one critic described it as like, it was soaked in Nevada bourbon, left hanging in the smokehouse for a few months, and then taken outside and run over with a car.
Well, Tom certainly inspires that kind of verbiage. He's one of the most creative writers. His voice is as unique as a novelist or a poet. He's using pieces and parts that we know from, you know, well, there's a little Louis Armstrong, and there's a little... this and a little Big Joe Turner and a little Lead Belly, a little that, you know, but it comes out so completely and totally Tom. He's really his own most original creation.
You, at the end of the book, you write a little bit looking back at your career, and you write that the whole rock critic thing was part of another era, the rock era. What do you think is the future of music criticism in this country, in the world?
Well, I think the future of music criticism, for what that's worth, is on the internet. And instead of like one guy with a job at the newspaper, there's thousands and thousands of people out there that have internet service providers, and they're letting us know what they think about all kinds of topics. And I find the multiplicity of voices to be just an enormously cheering prospect. I get out there on the web myself and find people talking about stuff I'm interested in with points of view that I hadn't occurred to me. And I'm much more informed and stimulated by the dialogue than I have been since the late 60s.
That's Joel Selvin. His new book is called Smart Ass, The Music Journalism of Joel Selvin. Happy New Year.
Let's hope it's a good one.
Open up your